What Hegel argued was that change is not an unpredictable, purely open kind of thing, or largely open kind of thing, but that there is a certain regular order to it. And it operates on this kind of principle. When something, which he called a thesis is anything which is, when something comes into being, by its very nature, and by the virtue of the nature of the universe, it tends to generate its opposite, that which is against it, the antithesis or antithesis. So the very existence of something generates opposition to it. So it always is creating its opposite. And so, of course, then you will get conflict and confrontation back and forth this way. What happens as a result of this conflict and confrontation, you can view this as though it were a thesis, is it will generate its antithesis. And that antithesis of conflict is harmony, concordia, or what he called the synthesis, where the theses get along with one another. So this is the opposite of this, and this is the opposite of this, except that in the synthesis, both the thesis and the antithesis are contained. We now have got a new kind of entity, and so, you know, everything which comes into being generates its opposite. And so we now get a new antithesis. And as a result of this opposition, we then get a new synthesis, which, being a new kind of thing, generates its opposite, and so on. See? So that's the way it goes. Now, this is a kind of logic. This is a dialectical logic of things in opposition to one another. And notice, this is historically first, this is historically second, this is historically third, historically fourth, historically fifth, and so it's moving through a temporal progression. Now, assuming that Hegel's right and that's the way change operates, this has certain kinds of advantages. It has at least two. One advantage is that you can predict the future, because if you can put your finger on the opposing forces of today, you can then logically conceive of what will synthesize them, and you can tell what's going to happen next. You can also go backwards in history, and we have enough history around that we can work out the chains of changes which have taken place. And so when you've got a run of things changing back and forth, you can go back prior to that time, and so we can not only predict, but we can post-dict. In other words, we can go back into so-called prehistory, and we can figure out what happened then, even though we have neither oral nor written record of that time. And so consequently, we can work backwards and we can work forward. Now, Hegel had a profound effect on the biological sciences, and the whole theory of evolution is based on Hegelian logical base. He had a profound effect in the field of theology, both directly and indirectly, through history of literary types, through anthropology, had a profound effect on geology, and you can see where this kind of approach would look very, very exciting because of the fact that, by golly, you can foretell the future, and you can, you know, you can figure out what the past was like, that the unknown past was like. So you can lay out the whole business in one grand system. Karl Marx was very much affected by Hegel, and Karl Marx applied Hegelian logic to the field of economics. And he came out with political theory on an economic base. Now, Karl Marx's years are 1818 to 1823. He worked very closely with another man, Friedrich Engels.
He was only five years old.
1893. 1893. 1818 to 18... Or check it. Double check it. Whether it's 93 or 73.
1883.
Neither one, 1883. And Frederick Daniels, 1820 to 1895. Both of these men are of Jewish background, but the fascinating thing about Karl Marx is that Karl Marx's parents were Lutherans. And in fact, the 19th century was a century during most of which there were a great many intellectual Jews who were Christians, mainly Lutherans. The latter part of the century, there was a strong push in Roman Catholic intellectual circles to get intelligent Jews, university grad educated Jews, to become Roman Catholics. But Karl Marx was raised as a little kid as a Lutheran. He didn't take too well. But at any rate, it's a little interesting side. That kind of makes one humble. But anyway, Karl Marx came up with the revolutionary idea that what brings about changes in human society is the economic structure of the society. It's not the kind of ideas that people have. It's not the form of government that they have. It's not the particular geniuses of the age. It is the way the society is organized to handle its economic activities. So the way that economic production is organized produces the social structure. Why? Because as soon as you develop an economic structure, you produce a community which begins to form into classes. I'll give you a very obvious example. Suppose that I'm out here in the Pacific Northwest and I got a big tract of land and I start farming it, and you know, I want life to get along better and better. Pretty soon I find that I need some help, and so I get somebody to come out and help me. And I have created two classes, the worker class and the employer class. And we're two different relationships. Now, this may be somebody who is a buddy of mine from back east or from the old country, and I bring him over to work for me. But as soon as he's there working for me, our relationship to one another changes. It's different from what it was. Because he's very conscious of the fact that he's working for me and he has to please me, where before he didn't have to please me. And I'm very conscious of the fact that I got to keep him occupied. And I have kind of a mixed feeling, because on the one hand, he's my old friend from back east there, or from the old country, and at the same time, he is working for me. And if he screws up, I can't let the bonds of friendship get in the way of getting the job done, or we're both going to go broke. And so, but anyway, I have generated the class relationship by virtue of setting up an economic unit. And then Marx argued that everything else follows from that. That economics produces sociology, and the kind of social structure which one has causes the kind of political structure one has, the intellectual history which is produced or which is advocated, the sort of political leaders one has, and so on. But down at the base of everything is the mode of economic production, and that is the ultimate. Well, that he called dialectical materialism. It is a materialistic base. It is the economics of the situation, the ultimate economic matter of the situation, that begins to generate a dialectic which keeps going on. Now what happens? As soon as you move from a situation, and Marx is coming pretty well at the end of a century and a half of almost pathological interest in the origin of things. You find one political writer after another that is interested in what it was like originally. What was man like originally? What kind of a critter was man to start with? How did where we are now come to be? And Marx comes pretty well at the end of that long line, and then after Marx comes Darwin, and after Darwin, you know, there's no new speculative thought about the origin of man as we know him today. But Marx, like everybody else, begins with a kind of situation where everything's public. There's no such thing as private property. Just stuff's there, people are here. Now, as soon as somebody takes something out of the public sector and converts it into the private sector, he has started an endless dialectic. You know, it's like Eve tasting the fruit. You know, this starts at the next dialectical movie, she offers it to Adam and then him. One thing leads to the next, and the mess gets worse and worse. So, with the beginning of private property, we set off a dialectical chain which keeps on going. What happens first is, let's say that Bible sitting there, instead of being a man-made product, is a natural thing. See, and I see it, and Ed sees it, and you know, we reach for it, and I get it, and as soon as I've got it, it's mine. See, and Ed looks at it, and for Ed, it's thine. It's mine over here. See, and so we have now. A relationship has come into being relative to that item, such that I have one relationship to it, a mine relationship, and his relationship relative to it and me is a thine relationship, and we are opposite to one another. And we generate, you know, a feeling of superiority on my part because I've got it and he doesn't. And a feeling of envy on his part that he hasn't got it and I have, and now he may start working around to see whether he can get one of those. And there's one line over here, and he scrambles over and gets that. You know, we have set off a chain of activity as a result of this, and we've established certain kinds of relationships. And these then generate additional relationships. Now, take you back a step and we'll put some more structure in it, and I'll take you through the history of relationships. I forgot to bring my visual aid, and I found one in the back of the room back there. So imagine this is a wheel. This is the wheel of history. And Marx literally uses that expression. This is the wheel of history. All right, what's this, Jerry, of the wheel?
Rotation.
I mean, different word.
Revolution.
It's a revolution of the wheel. It's a revolution of the wheel, okay? See? Close. See, it's a revolution of the wheel. And that's what Marx means when he talks about revolution. See, not that sort of thing, but that's a revolution. See, what causes the revolution? The dialectical antagonistic interaction of classes on an economic base. All right, what kind of forces do we have? What kind of forces can you have relative to a wheel moving in a plane? Well, you can have a force that goes this way, right? What do we call that? What kind of a force is that? That wants to go forward.
Progressive.
All right, Jerry, here you go. What kind of force is this one? That's reactionary. What kind of force is it that holds it like this so it can't go forward or backward? That's a status quo kind of force, see? So you got three kind of forces always operating at any point in history. One kind of force is trying to push it this way, one kind of force is trying to push it this way, and one kind of force is trying to hold it right there. Right now, if you would imagine that people were all around this wheel, and you have people that are on top and people that are on the bottom. Who's trying to push the wheel forward? The guy that's on the bottom. Why? Because he wants to get on top. Who's trying to hold it right where it is? The guys that are right on top. Who are the guys that are trying to push it back this way? The guys that are over on this side, see, they used to be on top and they aren't anymore. They're getting rolled under. See, they're getting, they've lost out. History has passed them by. And so we always have those kinds of forces in a society. Now, if progression is good and change is good, which way should the wheel of history be going?
North.
Oh, yeah, always this way. And anybody that's pushing it this way, you know, wants to go backwards or back to the good old days or the good old times and so on for whatever reason. These are the old fuddy-duddy reactionaries. And the guys that are trying to fix history, see, these are the self-centered guys that don't want history to progress. And the interesting little section in Nietzsche, who knew something of Marx, in his Thus Spake Zarathustra, where Zarathustra is talking to mankind, and he said, the rocks and fields were willing to sacrifice their autonomy that the plants might be. And the plants were willing to sacrifice themselves that the animals might be. And the animals were willing to sacrifice themselves so that man might be. But man says that he is the crown of creation and is unwilling to sacrifice himself for anyone. See, and he was arguing for progressive evolution. And from this end, he spun out his whole revolution of morals and said, we must go back to the ethics of survival of the fittest and the war of all against all so that the evolutionary wheel of history can progress. So, well, this is good in one sense. In another sense, what tends to happen in Marx is the farther the wheel goes, the more screwed up and the worse it gets. But you can't go back because the wheel of history inevitably moves forward. Two forces work there. One is numbers, the other one is weight of capital. What tends to happen is when we get a movement of the wheel, what tends to happen is over a period of time you get a dropping down of people to the bottom so that there are a smaller and smaller number of people at the top controlling a larger and larger amount of capital. More and more capital tends to drift up this way to the top so that finally you have a small number of people controlling more and more of the economy, a larger and larger number of people at the bottom trying to push this way, and what happens? Capital is a dead weight. You got a whole bunch of capital sitting here. You got a whole lot of people pushing this way, a few people holding it so it doesn't go this way or that way, and what happens? Boop! It flips over. You get a revolution. And what now happens is you've got a new economic state of affairs. And then another process goes on. And gradually the same kind of forces work and then, bloop, it flips over again. And so a period of time where you have a kind of holding force before it flips, he calls an era. A stage of time with a particular kind of organization of people. And then comes a revolution, a rather rapid economic change, and it shifts over. Now, Marx never been able to find anywhere in Marx that Marx suggested that there ever was any need for violence. Now, he recognized the fact that the boys on the top are going to use every tool at their disposal to stay on top. And the guys who are getting squashed on the bottom aren't going to worry about the Marquess of Queensbury rules to get on top. But there doesn't necessarily have to be civil war and bloodshed and fighting in the streets and so on for revolution to take place. And as a matter of fact, oftentimes revolutions take place quite bloodlessly. And so consequently, revolution for Marx generically simply means a shift of the wheel of history, where another group, another class gets to the top. And as a result of its getting to the top, it begins to produce its opposing class, and then there's struggle between the two of them, and then it flips over again. And you usually have a class becoming obsolete and disappearing, you know, that wants to push it back to the good old days. All right. And you read in different places in Marx and Engels, and you'll get different sequences, and it's rather difficult to to come out with a kind of overall one. But here's one that I put together. The first economic unit that we find in history is the farmer. The guy who is tilling the soil, who is domesticating the soil, who has moved from a dependence on the wild fruits of the earth to organizing the land and organizing his existence and making it less precarious. All right, now he probably sooner or later becomes aware of the fact that since farming is tough work and it's the sort of thing that only the younger person can do in the primitive form, sooner or later, time's going to come when he can't farm anymore, life's going to be extremely difficult, and boy, he better have something figured out for that time. What's the best thing you can have for your old age? A strong, strapping son or two who will run the farm. You know, you can hand the farm on to them, or you can hang on to the farm and give them orders, and they go out and do the farming. And, you sit in the living room and relax a bit, or maybe go out and supervise a little bit, you know. But life goes on. All right, now what do you have to do to have sons? Well, you got to have a wife. And you got to establish some kind of a permanent relationship with her so that you're going to have those sons to run that farm for you when you get too old to do it yourself. And so, you develop the family relationship. Well, as soon as you've got a family, you now have a kind of internal class system where you got parents, kids. See, and the parents are on top of the wheel and kids are on the bottom of the wheel, right? Unless there's a revolution in the house, in which case the kids run the show and the parents run for the kids. But, hopefully that's not going to happen. And Larry was talking on 4th of July about children's liberation. Well, what he's talking about is, how do you get the wheel to turn over in such a way that nobody gets squashed in the process, either the kids or the parents? As time moves on and as they achieve their maturity. Okay, so you develop the family unit. Now, yours isn't the only family unit that forms, and so pretty soon you've got your family, and somebody else has got their family going, and it's our family, it's your family. See, and it's our farm, and it's your farm. And then your grandpa, because your sons see the wisdom of your way of solving problems, and so they get wives, and they got kiddies, and your grandpa. See, and then a few generations go by, and all of a sudden you have a tribal relationship that has emerged. And as you're going, you see that there's no fights yet. And nobody's killing anybody else, necessarily. May have a Cain in the outfit who can't get along with his brother, and sibling rivalry gets too strong, and, they clobber one another. But it's not essential that this happen. And so, at any rate, you have now moved from a pure, simple farmer onto tribal organization. A great percentage of the world today is still organized on a tribal basis. Most of Africa is organized on a tribal basis, and they're pretending that it's organized on a national basis when it really isn't, because most people's strongest loyalties are to their tribe, which may cross over four or five different countries. And when the chips are down, they fight for the tribe and not for the country, which makes it difficult to rule Africa. And will continue to some extent. This is true also in South America. And I suppose if the chips were really down, and if someone had to choose between being an Irishman and being an American, it might be a bit of a question for some of them which way they wanted to go. We all know what the problem is for American Jewish people. We have very strong feelings of ethnic identification with the people in Israel. And what would they do if the United States got involved in a war against Israel? How do you handle that sort of thing? So there's this ethnic identification also of people in the United States. American Indians certainly have much stronger identification, most of them, much stronger identification with their tribe than with the United States of America. So there's a lot of that, but at any rate, this is a relatively primitive, early level of social organization arising out of an economic kind of situation. Well, the next one that Marx thought would evolve out of that one was the town community. And you can see the town community developing rather obviously. It means you can see it develop in the early part of this century in the United States as we began to move from a town, from an agricultural rural type nation with seaboard cities to an urban kind of civilization as we have today. There you got all these farms stretched all over the county. And farmers need implements. They need grain. They need a place where they can get rid of their crops and exchange them. You need a railhead for transporting in, transporting out. You need a place where mom can get some cloth for making dresses and so on. And a little trading area begins to emerge. Well, it gets up to a certain size and it satisfies the needs of the farmers roundabout. Bear in mind, Sears Roebuck hasn't been invented yet. But it satisfies the needs of the farmers and they all come into town on Saturday and do their shopping, right? This is still true in much of rural America today. And then you got all those grandpas around, you know, whose sons and grandsons are running the farm now. And grandpa says, gee, it's kind of isolated in the winter and there's nobody to talk to and nothing to do and the young'uns are kind of noisy. Maybe mom and me will build a house in town, right? See, so a good many of our towns are the products, you know, fairly good-sized towns, are the products of elderly farmers retiring and leaving their kids out in the farm to run the farm. But grandma and grandpa are living in town, and so the town develops. So we begin to shift from an agricultural sort of situation to a town sort of situation. What begins to emerge in the town that we never had before? The merchant, the mercantile class. See? And so we have the emergence of trade. And as trade begins to develop more and more, it becomes increasingly unhandy to deal purely in terms of stuff and bartering buffalo hides for hogsheads of tobacco and things of that sort. You know, and so sooner or later money gets invented and then we're off to the races. So we then move from a town sort of situation to a city kind of situation, and from a city kind of situation we move to a feudalistic kind of situation, because as soon as you get a large number of people together with one another, what inevitably begins to emerge is some of them think they are better than others, right? Do you know of any large city in the United States that doesn't have its 400 who are all, you have a special section in every local newspaper that caters to feelings of superiority. We call it the society piece. In this age of people fighting for equality, I cannot understand why we still have society page. You know, because the society page always assumes that we are all equal, but some of us are better than others, right? And so when Susie Gottrox gets engaged and married, her picture goes in the paper and a reporter from the paper covers her wedding, but not when my kid gets married, because we're not important and she is. Well, at any rate, this begins to merge and all of a sudden you have the very important people. Now, for people to be very important, there have to be a lot of people that aren't important. Right? And we call the very important people lords, and we call the unimportant people serfs. So you got the people that count, the ones that get in history books, and the people that don't count, the ones that produce, that do all the work and make money so that the people that count don't have to work. So you begin to have these two classes emerging, and you have nobility and you've got the common ordinary people. What eventually arises out of this, by virtue of this trade business, is a middle class. And eventually what happens then is the middle class takes over from the better people and takes over a task which the better people always found very distasteful, namely oppressing the serfs. They never liked to do it, but it was necessary in order to remain better. And so they take over that tasteless job from the better people so that the better people can just go on being better. Well, gradually the better people continue to be better, but they no longer are an economically viable unit in the economy. You know, they're just sort of floating there, and the money begins to leave them, and pretty soon, you know, they're aristocratic and poor, and they just sort of hang on there and hope that maybe they can marry the daughter of some middle-class millionaire and go back to living in the style that they were accustomed to. So what emerges then, as we have a middle class coming out, is what Marx called capitalism. And the nobility just kind of sloughs off and just kind of hangs there and gets tolerated for a while, but finally just disappears. I mean, there are only so many restaurants that you can have faded nobility run, you know, or cute tour shops or something like that, you know, or boutiques. There are only so many they can run. And the rest of them somehow or other have to be gainfully employed. So you can't apply for food stamps when you own a castle, even if you can't afford the castle. So at any rate, they become obsolete, get disposed of in one way or another, and then you have a kind of society in which you have employer, employee operating. And you have capitalism operating. What has tended to happen through history from the beginning to the end is, on the bottom, you have tended to get a larger and larger and larger and larger percentage of the total society that have got little or nothing. It keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, just like our wars get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and we kill more and more and more and more in each war. So it's getting worse and worse and worse, and the more history progresses, the worse it gets. Now, Karl Marx looked at the whole situation, and he says, where did we go wrong? What is the cause of this mess that we find ourselves in that we call the Industrial Revolution, which is the worst time in which man has ever lived? How did we get here? We got here by the idea of private property. Because you remember we started out when I grabbed that book, you know, and Ed didn't get it, and all of a sudden I had something that was mine, and he didn't have anything. That's what started the whole mess. So consequently, what did that create? That created classes. What would happen if we got rid of classes? We wouldn't have any more antagonisms. Everybody would be like everybody else. How can we get rid of classes? Get rid of private property. Then you won't have any more classes, because it's the economics that creates the society. So this is what we've got to do. We have to produce a classless society where there's no private property, and then everything's going to be great. See? In a nutshell, there's Karl Marx. Okay. So consequently, what we do then is we attempt to figure out some kind of way whereby we can shift from capitalism to a public, everything back in the public domain kind of situation, and the elimination of classes. Well, the official elimination of classes you can do rather easily. All you have to do is pass a law. There'll be no more classes. It's like they did in India to get rid of the caste system. They passed the law. Not been very effective, been somewhat effective, but it hasn't been effective at the extremes. It has been in the middle. The Brahmins still don't talk to anybody but other Brahmins, and nobody talks to the untouchables, but the middle classes are all getting along pretty well with one another, and the castes have pretty well disappeared. Except for the extremes, you know, the better people and the serfs. Those are always the ones that are the problems. But you can sort of legislate that out of existence, but even legislation is not going to overcome economics. So you've got to solve the thing on the economic level. So consequently, what Marx said was we've got to have the proletariat, the guys who work. Proletariat he defined as anybody who possesses only his capacity to labor as a means of survival. It's a good definition of the typical college student, right? You know, those who use that in college. You possess only, you know, you live from one paycheck to the next paycheck at the greasy spoon as you're working your way through college. But this was the proletariat. He foresaw that there would be more and more and more of these people, that there would be a tendency toward fewer and fewer and fewer people on the top, and so consequently what ultimately had to happen was that the proletariat would have to grab the means of capital production and run it for the benefit of the proletariat. Now, as soon as they grabbed it, what would happen to the people that owned it? They wouldn't own it anymore. Therefore, they would be what? Proletarians. See, then everybody would be a proletarian. All you got to do is grab the means of production and make it public. Then nobody owns anything. And the economics of the situation will produce the classless society, eventually. Now, as soon as you've got a classless society, what will tend to happen then is the antagonisms will disappear. When antagonisms, conflicts between people disappear, what don't you need? A government. So government will disappear. And then you will have a classless society where everything is possessed publicly, where there is no need for government. Will the dialectic go on? No, because it's caused by class conflict. So time will stand still as far as history is concerned, and it will be a kind of a panacea. So what you have to achieve is public ownership of everything, elimination of all classes, and the rest automatically will happen if the theory is right. If the theory is wrong, you killed an awful lot of people for nothing. See? But anyway, he said that the proletariat must seize the means of production. So he uses a violent verb. But doesn't necessarily mean we have to have a big revolution. But they have to grab it and expropriate it from the absentee landlords who owned it, which means that then they'd have to go to work. But this is how it would happen. So you would establish a temporary state of the proletariat where the proletariat would run the state for the sake of everyone. Everyone would be equal to everybody else in that nobody had anything, and they shared equally what they had according to a principle of justice called from everyone according to his ability. You do what you're able to do, you get what you need. To each one according to his needs. So you don't relate what you get to what you produce, but you relate it to what you need. So if I'm strong as a bull and can work 18 hours a day, I should work 18 hours a day, and if I only need a half pound of rice to keep me going, all I should get is a half pound of rice. And if Terry can only work 6 hours a day and he needs 3 or 4 steaks to keep him going, so he works 6 hours a day and he gets 3 or 4 steaks. That's the way it operates. Why should it be any different? All you have a right to is what you need, not any more than you need. And what you owe is what you can do. Well, they've never been successful in getting that one to work, although it's a better principle of justice than anybody, of social justice than anyone else has come up with. All right, well, so much for Marx, kind of a capsule. As you all know, Lenin pulled it off in the Soviet Union. One of the ironies about that situation is when Marx and Engels speculated about where the communist revolution was going to occur, they both agreed that it was going to occur in Germany. If it didn't occur because Germany was ripe for something or other, it was in a post-feudalist, pre-industrial kind of shape, and it was pretty bad. It was also weak enough that they thought they could take it over. They thought that if it didn't happen in Germany, it would surely happen in France. And one place where they knew it would never happen, because that country was so antique and out of touch with and out of step with everything, was the Soviet Union. And so as prophets, they weren't too hot. As economists, they were pretty sharp. So at any rate, you know, Lenin succeeded then. Now, what was Lenin's problem? Well, we had a violent revolution. A lot of people got executed. A lot of people got suppressed. They took property away from all sorts of people. What was Lenin's problem? Lenin had to prove that for communism to occur, the revolution had to be violent. That the seizure by the proletariat had to be a violent seizure. And so most of Lenin's writings are devoted to proving, in quotes, from Marx and Engels, that every revolution must of necessity be violent. Okay, Stalin replaces Lenin. What's Stalin's problem? See, it's been a proletarian dictatorship of the proletariat, People's Democratic Republic. For a generation, Stalin comes in. What's Stalin's problem? No withering away of the state. It's still, it's a dictatorship. It's a repressive dictatorship. What's Stalin's problem? How come we haven't got the withering away of the state? My golly, we call one another comrades for 20 years now. Nobody's had anything for as far back as we can think, you know. How come paradise has not emerged? And so most of Stalin's writings are oriented to proving that it is necessary for the proletariat state to last for a long time before it withers away and the communist society, classless society comes into being, or stateless society comes into being. All right. Mao Zedong comes along, and I told you we'd get up to Mao today. Mao Zedong comes along, and Mao is a Marxist-Leninist communist. He likes to call himself a Marxist-Leninist communist. Doesn't put Stalin in there because that's not popular. But he's a Marxist-Leninist communist. What's Mao's problem? Mao's problem is China is a feudalistic country. See, the Soviet Union had been an early industrial country. The serfs had all been freed about two-thirds of a century before the time of Tolstoy as a result of the efforts of Tolstoy and others of the nobility. But China is a great feudalistic, bureaucratic nation, if you can call it that. Really an ethnic group more so than a nation. And what Mao's problem was, can you jump a stage? Can you leap, make a great leap forward from a feudalistic society to past, over and through modern industrialist society into communist society? This was the big challenge for Mao. And so his great leap forward of the 50s was considerably more, you know, than we tended to realize. It was a test of communist theory and whether the dialectic of history permitted you to jump a generation, to jump an epoch and to go from one to the next. Now, it failed miserably. There still are a bunch of those backyard steel refineries that they tried to develop back in those years as they went in fast industrial and into People's Republic. And I think Mao kind of reconciled himself to the fact
that he was that he almost had to produce a sort of modern industrial China, but of a special sort, and have to go through that stage, although in a controlled kind of way, before he could get into the communist classless, stateless society. Well, next time I'll start out in Mao and some of the basic doctrines of Mao, with particular emphasis on how he is different from the Soviet version. And Mao Zedong is extremely important, much more important than people tend to realize, because Mao's variety of communism is considerably more attractive than any other variety of communism. It has a lot of very nice looking things, and it has a lot of good points about it. And it has been successful where the Russian variety has not. And so consequently, and it is, you know, for all practical purposes, controls virtually all of the Orient today, that sort of thinking. Vietnam fell, you know, Laos is gone, Cambodia is gone, Thailand will probably not last much longer, and Burma will go. Both on political grounds and on an ideological grounds, the Chinese variety of communism doesn't have that rough, tough, cruel, brutal, hard-nosed kind of approach toward life that the Russian variety does. It's aesthetically much more satisfying, and so consequently, it represents a much bigger threat. Notice that last week the Italians voted again. They seem to vote almost every week. But the Italians voted again, but as of last week, the Italian Communist Party is the majority party. I should say the majority party is the largest political party in Italy. Italy has about a dozen parties, but it's still a minority party, but it is now the largest political party in Italy. The French Communist Party is growing. And we have to know what it's all about, because it is gaining, and gaining rapidly. We used to say the only countries that were communist were countries which had been seized against the will of the people. Well, that's not the name of the game anymore today. And there are countries that are going communist because they prefer it to the alternatives that they see that they're offered. And so we have to know what it's all about, how it works, and what one can do about it. And that's what we'll be concerned with the rest of the week. But now it's coffee time.